Accession number 9338, reel 4.
Doug Turner, tape 4. Could I ask you about the organisation of this community? Was there a hierarchy, for instance? Was there a boss or a leader?
There was certainly no boss, and there was no hierarchy as usually understood by the term. Indeed, we were very, very definite that this just not was not a part of community whatsoever. This has always been, I think, a constant problem in many communities. However, we felt from the very beginning that we should share as much of the work as possible, and even discussed as to whether we shouldn't even, at the end of each year, do a spell in, for example, the task of responding to letters and the general administration. Edmund, however, took on most of these tasks in addition to his position in the community as work leader. Although I'm not quite sure that even that is the term. We never had posts as such. We accepted that there were certain tasks for which certain people were most suited, and therefore we accepted that it was their responsibility to organise that part of the work, and we cooperated. This did not exclude us from all questioning, however. Questioning went on all the time, but there was never any never in the sense of criticism. It was in the sense of, well, what do we do next? And we would spend our evenings perhaps discussing next day's work, getting it organised, and or in other activities.
How did you cope for transport?
We had cycles. Fortunately, the farm we had was about a mile outside the village itself. We were quite isolated and along a little country lane, and there were buses from the village into Ipswich, which we very rarely ever used. We all had cycles, or most of us had cycles, and we used this for most purposes. We also had a motorcycle, which we used for the transport of vegetables into the town. A motorcycle and a sidecar.
How do you think the ideal of this community lived up to the reality that you experienced?
You asked here a very deep question. The question of individualism and community. And, of course, whatever our ideals might have been, I think we must recognise that man's individualism still remains dominant. This is not to say that for the purposes of community that men cannot sink their individualism, but the battle is always there. It always exists. This is a part of human living. It must be. It would be a state of utopia if it were not so. And although we had a vision of an ideal society, maybe a utopian one, I think, were we to ever reach utopia, then it could be rather a terrible place to live in. At one level, we were great realists. At other levels, I suppose, we were naive young people. We had to learn the hard way. Yet, I would think that it's true to say that after all these years, the experience which we all had then still maintains us today in whatever task we may be doing. The nucleus of that small group still exists in ongoing contact and communication. We're still very deep friends. We may have gone along different paths, but I think whatever path we may have gone along, whether it's education, social work, or whatever task which individuals have taken up, have all been deeply influenced by the experience we had in living in community. That can't be doubted. For some, perhaps, community was a period of disillusion. It certainly was with many of the communities which sprung up at a later period and during the war. But also, for many others, it led on to other things, if not community, as a particular way of life, community as an expression of their concern in the world. One or two of our members ultimately joined the Bruderhof, for example, and are still living in the Bruderhof for full community life.
Could I ask you about the local attitudes towards you? You know, you've explained about the farmers, but did this change at all when war broke out in September 1939?
I think we were in an unusual situation there. People did not really understand what we were trying to do. There was a deep inbred suspicion of us as foreigners. And remember that in Suffolk, particularly, I think, of all counties, perhaps of East Anglia as a whole, there was a deep-rooted suspicion of anybody who might come from more than a few miles away. Certainly when I moved over to other parts of England, I did not experience the same antagonism as we had in those days. We had a kind of outward friendliness, for example, by the local Anglican churchmen, clergyman, but I think he wasn't very happy with our presence, and unfortunately the people whom we were most concerned with, the worker on the farm, he could be quite antagonistic at times. On the other hand, as we worked with our neighbours' workmen, we made quite a good relationship with them. They couldn't understand us, but at a personal level, they were very friendly disposed. I think it was mainly the more ignorant section of the village itself who resented us. Later on, as time went on, I think they began to accept us more. They got to know us as individuals. Although at one time, I still recall one time when three or four of the younger element came up to the community and began shouting abuse at us. And at first we didn't reply, we didn't respond, but it became very abusive indeed. And we're human still, and after we had got through trying to talk with them, they broke out into another load of verbal abuse. And it so happened that Bert and I, who had continued trying to maintain communication, got rather short-tempered and began a quick step towards them, whereupon they bolted for their lives, which was rather an interesting insight perhaps into our own pacifism and an insight into their own aggression.
That was my next question. I was wondering how active your pacifism was at this moment. You know, it would sound as if you were becoming...
I think most pacifists probably by nature tend to be a little aggressive. I suppose we have to be. We try to channel our aggression into creative activities, however. But that paradoxical situation, I think, is a necessary part of genuine, authentic peace, the peace movement. I think it has to be. One sees it today again. Without that, I'm not sure that we could be pacifist. To me, pacifism has never meant passivism. I've always found it extremely difficult to be a pacifist, I suppose. I know the violence is there, and I'm not sure that it's always unjustified, and I'm not sure in the final analysis whether I would be 100% pacifist. I think there may be times when physical steps may be necessary.
How far would you do you think you would be prepared to go with these physical steps?
Today?
No. Perhaps at that time. You know, how far would you?
I think. Mixed with our practicality, I think also there was, of course, a certain naivety. We wanted to be what we believed. How many of us can achieve that? Maybe at, I suppose, it's like the whole old question of courage and cowardice. At one time, the coward can be a very courageous and brave man. At another time, the opposite operates. Who's to know why or when or how or what? I think this is a matter of human living and the situation you may be in at any given moment. I don't think there's a final answer to that.
Do you still feel the same today about it, or have you changed your attitude?
I've probably modified some aspects of my pacifism. I think I can imagine situations in which, as an individual, I might and would take direct action. I hope I could find other alternatives first. But when it comes to mass violence, then I will have no part in it whatsoever. I think that still remains. Although I can understand, for example, the situations as they exist today with people rising up against injustice. If I lived in their situation, I probably would myself. Certainly, in China, these sort of situations arose in our minds. I think what William Blake said some 200 years ago still rings true, however. And if I may quote the words from his poem, The Grey Monk. My brother starved between two walls. His children's cry my soul appalls. I mocked at the rack and the grinding chain. My bent body mocks their torturing pain. Thy father drew his sword in the north. With his thousand strong he marched forth. Thy brother has armed himself in steel to avenge the wrongs thy children feel. But vain the sword and vain the bow, they never can work war's overthrow. The hermit's prayer and the widow's tear alone can free the world from fear. For a tear is an intellectual thing, and a sigh is the sword of an angel king, and the bitter groan of the martyr's woe is an arrow from the Almighty's bow. The hand of vengeance found the bed to which the purple tyrant fled. The iron hand crushed the tyrant's head and became a tyrant in his stead. How's that?
I was asking you, about the local attitudes to you, Doug. Did they change once war was declared? Was there an intensity?
Yes, I think there was a modification there. The war had started, and they began to show more friendliness. Certainly, one or two people had always been friendly. I think the barriers did begin to break down.
But was that surprising? When war was declared, that they were more friendly than less friendly?
It didn't happen overnight. I think it was a question largely of them becoming aware that we existed and that we began to take on a new meaning. And I don't know, meaning is not right. An acceptance. We were becoming accepted as part of the I wouldn't say part of the village, but that we lived there, and the tension did ease. Yes.
How did war affect the community? You know, did life go on much the same, or were there, you know, serious disturbances?
It didn't affect the community as such, but I remember the day war was declared and the sense of despair we felt. That went very, very deep. We felt we'd come to a crisis within the movement, not within the community, but within mankind itself. I remember thinking at the time of old school friends I knew, and that they were just being taken off to become cannon fodder, without protest, without even any sense of awareness, just accepting it, just a repetition, I imagined, of the First World War. Certainly with more cause, one must accept that. There was less cause for the First World War, and I suppose relatively it was a just cause. But nevertheless, I felt a sense of despair that they were going to have to participate, to be killed. And I remember at one point weeping at the thought of all this.
How about your own situation? What did you think would happen to you? Because after all, you would have been of military age now, wouldn't you?
My tribunal had already occurred. No, let me recall. Conscription took place in the summer, I believe, of 1939, and I received my tribunal.
Did you register as a conscript?
I registered, yes, indeed. Perhaps I should go back there. We had discussed within the community what we should do when conscription took place. Most of us felt, I think, we should participate by registering, although Horace took a strong stand on this and said he felt that he should not register. We had a little bit of a difference about this, but ultimately we accepted his individual concern, and when the time came to registering, I took his own letter saying that he was not going to register to the Labour Exchange, and they duly accepted this. And in due course, I had to appear before the tribunal. I think war had already broken out when I attended this in Cambridge. I had asked for unconditional exemption.
Did you know all about the procedure? You know, had somebody told you about this?
Oh yes, yeah. Well, we were familiar with it in reports in the peace press, but we weren't unduly worried by this. It didn't give us any room for concern. We knew it was going to come, and in due course, I was the first one to go to the tribunal, and I'd made it quite clear in my appeal that I was not prepared to accept anything less than unconditional, naturally not knowing what the result would be. But I said very, very little in my actual statement, half a dozen lines perhaps, and that I'd come to community because of my commitment, and that I wasn't prepared to go to any other place to work. And on balance, it was a very fair tribunal at Cambridge, although I believe I was the only one to get unconditional that day.
Can you remember who the judge was?
Yes, indeed. It was Judge Chapman. Professor Clapham, presumably from the university. Bill Holmes, who was then the Secretary of the Agriculture Workers Union. And I believe there was another member, but who it was, I can't recall.
How did they behave towards you?
They behaved very, very politely, very courteously. And as I began to build up my case, they very politely interrupted and said, well, we'll hear about that later, as I began to, I suppose, expound upon the community. I didn't find them at all antagonistic, although I did observe, I thought a little unfairly, that students who appeared before them, they gave them quite a rough going over. I suppose I was fortunate, I don't know quite why, but one of our other members, he came along with me. He got conditional, provided he remained on agriculture. But for some reason, I was granted what I asked for, and that was that.
Was that unusual to get, you know, unconditional exemption?
Yes, it was. We were in the minority, and of course, it varied from tribunal to tribunal. Some tribunals wouldn't give it at all. East Anglia Tribunal, I think, had a fairly good reputation, and certainly towards me they were very fair, although I certainly sympathised with some of my comrades in the movement who had to appear before some of the quite tough tribunals. In fact, I think once or twice they were taken to task by government because of their attitude.
Can you think of any particular tribunal which was regarded by COs as being very hard?
I could quote, but I mean it would have to be from a book.
No, that's fine. It's just if it was in your mind.
Yes, no. I seem to recall, but I wouldn't like to accuse particular tribunals without checking back. I mean, they just built up a reputation.
Did you find that the basis of pacifism was important? For instance, if you were religious rather than political?
Yes, I think there was a tendency for tribunals to regard the religious objector with more sympathy than maybe those who took a moral stand, and more particularly because those who took a political stand. I always thought this was very unfair, but I guess that's the nature of the of our society.
Can you remember your own witness? What the ground, you know, when you made your own witness?
Yes, I made it specifically Christian at the time, but certainly none theological, none. I didn't belong to any religious group at all.
Did you have any connections with the Quakers?
Oh, yes. Yes, I before I went to the community, I had started going to occasional Quaker meetings. I never felt wholly able to join them at that time, but I had quite a strong feeling towards Friends. They had, after all, been the one religious body who had stood out wholeheartedly against all wars, and we regarded ourselves in many ways, I suppose, as a Quaker-oriented community, although we felt that we had moved more radically than perhaps Friends were prepared to at the time. And there was a Quaker farmer nearby, Philip Butler, who I think I might have mentioned before, who was involved in the tithe issue, and he lived at Needham Market, about 4 or 5 miles away, and we used to cooperate with him in labour and other activities, and we used to go along to the Friends meeting there at Barking Tye on occasion, and also in Ipswich. But at the time when we formed the community, there were no actual Quaker members. One or two joined later on.
Did you form any opinion if the Quakers were treated in a special way at the tribunals?
I think, again, that there was a tendency to give friends more of a hearing than other people, obviously for historical reasons. Friends had already made their impression in the peace movement, and quite rightly, I suppose, they were entitled to a response by the authorities.
Had you worked out, when you went to your tribunal, what you were prepared to do in war and what you weren't prepared to do?
I was not prepared to accept anything other than unconditional exemption, not even agriculture. Because, I mean, it could be that I might be doing something other than agriculture, but still linked to a specific community purpose. And in that, I felt that that I required unconditional exemption. I regarded myself as having made a responsible decision, and I was not to prepare to allow anyone to take that responsibility away from me.
Would you have gone to prison if necessary?
Yes, I think I would have done. I wouldn't have looked forward to it at all. I certainly hoped it would not have ended like that. I'm not a martyr oriented in any way. Yes, I would have done, I suppose. Yes, I'm sure I would have done.
Did you know anything about the COs in World War One?
Having read of a little bit about them, of course, in the various peace journals of the time, and also having met one or two, I knew a little of them, yes, sir, but mainly through reading.
Did that worry you, you know, the way they were treated? Did you think it might...
No, it didn't worry me. I just felt a sense of total injustice about it. I mean, it strengthened my my own feelings, as the experiences of my father did. What he experienced, and what I came to learn later from him of what happened in the war, had taken away any schoolboy patriotic feelings, which I might have had, and I certainly had them. I thought, as a schoolboy, I mean, England was the greatest country in the world, and the British soldier was the finest soldier in the world, and the British Empire was the finest empire in the world. I had no doubts about that. After all, that's what we were taught, and that's what we believed, and I probably believed it more than most people. I was quite a little patriot.